productive it's never been made to. So unless you intentionally target reproductive as an instructor, you got it. So but that's one thing I would say is that reproductive juice is off, but you're doing something else that's probably going to be a physiology. So what I will do is come up with an idol or a whole test or something that can give you an idea of what I would have expected and how we were going to do those portions.
Just for information.
Okay.
Yes. Okay.
No grade attached to it at all.
Good.
I think it will help you next year or next semester when you take this. Okay. All right. So, let's see. So, I'm going to try to make it through everything that I have told y'all as far as digestive and pulmonary should be finalized today. If I get a little time to throw urinary in a little bit today, I will, but that is kind of going to be the limit for today of how much I'll be able to get through and actually have a practical way before y'all even walk in the door.
Can you also please review I'm just so scattered, so maybe what's going to be on the final, like?
Yes, I will cover what's going to be on the final today before we walk out the door. Because there's one section that I'm going to walk and I'm going to just out of, well, there's a more material kind of aspect. We started covering this last time. Yeah, literally I probably should have finished it, but I think it was already over last time. Respiratory and there's 50 slides of digestive, which can take about an hour and a half. Okay.
Oh yeah, I could stop here.
This one? Thank you. Yeah. That's close to that. Okay. So, last time something that I had talked about is I had actually sat down and talked about the alveoli themselves and how they are interconnected with the pulmonary capillaries. The pulmonary capillaries is where you're trying to get the oxygen in and the carbon dioxide out. So that way you can actually have you can have respiration. You can have cells that have oxygen that they need and you can get rid of carbon dioxide buildup that you need to get rid of, otherwise your cells will start to die. Because of the affinity for carbon dioxide in your red blood cells. All right, so something else that I talked about is the alveolar macrophages. So this is your first line of defense. Okay, this first line of defense, well, I say first line, it's not truly the first line, but it's the first active line. Everything else is just up to this point has been basically passive because you've had mucus that's going to catch it, hopefully, and if it does, it may make its way down before it starts to grow into your digestive tract, and hopefully it doesn't end up in your digestive tract. Okay? So, this is the first one where the macrophages will actually engulf and digest or break down the cell that is coming in. Alright, so the location of the lungs, they occupy the thoracic cavity, they have an apex, which is the top, the pointed end. They have a base, which is the rounded end. Okay, it is curved to fit in on top of the diaphragm. Okay, and you are going to have the right lung and the left lung. The right lung is larger. It has three lobes. The left lung is smaller. It has two lobes, and it has a cardiac notch. So this cardiac notch is actually allowing for the heart, okay? So the heart and the aorta. All right, so the pleura. So a double-layered serosal sac is surrounding each lung. So there's one for each lung. You have the parietal pleura, which lines the thoracic cavity. Okay, parietal around. Visceral pleura, which is going to line the lung walls themselves. And then inside that, you're going to have the pleural cavity space, which is between the two layers and it's filled with fluid. It does allow for a little bit of movement. So what I mean by that is if you inhale and you forcibly inhale, there is a little bit of give in that membrane layer. Okay, that fluid can shift around to give you a little give. This, if you take and have any kind of impact to the chest, okay, this is going to absorb some of that to prevent your alveoli from impacting the side of your lung and becoming damaged. Okay? Alright, so it does allow for friction-free movement. Now, okay, that's relative. So, in biology, we consider it friction-free. Your physics teacher would laugh at me and call me crazy if I said that. Okay? Because there is virtually no friction-free surface in the world. Okay? Alright. So, anatomy of the lungs. Looking at the lungs themselves, you have a ileum. So it is the groove where the bronchus is going to actually insert. You also have blood vessels in that area and nerves that are going to insert into the lungs. You have, for your right lung, you have a horizontal and an oblique fissure because you have the three lobes. Okay, so you have a superior, middle, and inferior lobe of your right lung. Your left lung only has two lobes. It's going to have an oblique fissure between the two of them, so off at an angle. Okay, the superior lobe and an inferior lobe. It also does have the cardiac notch. So, cardiac notch itself, you can see here, is fairly pronounced when you look at it from a side view. Okay, the cardiac notch, like I said, is making space for the heart. All right. So, blood supply and innervation of lungs. You have pulmonary arteries that are going to deliver oxygen for blood to the lungs. Pulmonary arteries are away from the heart. In this case, they're taking away from the heart to the lungs to be oxygenated. That is why it's deoxygenated. Okay? Make sure you've got that straight in your brain. Okay? Pulmonary veins carry oxygenated blood to the heart. Okay, so veins bring blood back to the heart. In this case, it's oxygenated, it is coming from the lungs. Bronchial arteries. These are going to supply oxygenated blood and nutrients to lung tissue because lungs are themselves a tissue and they do have to have their own circulation. If they don't have their own circulation, they can't get rid of the carbon dioxide they need to get rid of. It would seem awesome just to say, oh yeah, they can exchange it for themselves. They really can't, okay?
The heart is a muscle.
Yes.
The lungs are a tissue,
not
a muscle.
There's no muscle there.
No muscle.
Oh. No. The only muscle, okay.
I've been trying to understand. Because I know that they pump and they work and that type of thing.
I left my markers over there in the lab. Alright, so when you're looking at your thoracic cavity, this is one of the primary muscles, which is your diaphragm.
That is the muscle that allows you to breathe.
Okay, there are a lot of other muscles, which we're going to get into here in a minute, that can allow you to forcibly exhale or forcibly inhale. Okay, so you're going to have your diaphragm, which is the primary one, and then you're also going to have in between your ribs, So in between the ribs, you've got an internal muscle set and an external muscle set, and these are called your iliocostals. okay? You have internal, external iliocostals. So your internal and external iliocostals can rotate the ribs individually. They go from rib to rib. So they will actually take and, based on their position, either pull, rotate the rib cage out or rotate the rib cage down and in. And by doing this, they can aid in respiration because they either increase the volume of your thoracic cavity or decrease the volume of your thoracic cavity. Okay? All three of these muscle sets work in concert together to do this. So this is where I'm going to go ahead and jump a little ahead of where I wanted to go. So your diaphragm is naturally in its relaxed position, arched, okay? Like the golden arches at McDonald's, okay? It has one primary arch, okay, if you look at it from the front. Now, that one primary arch, when you contract a muscle, okay, all it's going to do is pull on both insertion and origin, okay? It's just gonna pull on. But when it does, it actually straightens out flat in this case. When it straightens out flat, it increases the volume of the thoracic cavity. So when it increases the volume of the thoracic cavity, you have increased volume, which actually takes and drops the pressure, okay? So now what you have is, so let's just say atmospheric pressure is, to give you a number, I will not expect you to remember this, 760 milligrams mercury, okay? Or millimeters mercury, my bad. So that's atmospheric pressure. That's one atmosphere what we're at sea level, okay? If you change this diaphragm, you can change this pressure. If you drop, so, okay. Trying to figure out all, it is physio. I'm trying to figure out all the equations in my head, but let's just go through the basics. I'm gonna give you a rough example. So now in your thoracic cavity, you have a pressure of just say 740 millimeters mercury. Because your diaphragm is straightened out.
When does that happen? When you're blowing out?
So this happens when you're trying to breathe in. So what happens is you drop this pressure. So since it's lower, when you open your mouth, air is going to flow in because you've got all the air above you pushing down and in. Okay? So all of that pressure is what led to the 760 millimeters mercury. Okay? That pressure means that air is going to flow in. So inhaling is more active than exhaling. Because now for an exhalation, you let your diaphragm relax. When your diaphragm relaxes, it decreases the volume in the cavity, thereby increasing the pressure. So that increases the pressure, you open your mouth and it forces it out. Okay? So your diaphragm is one of the main controllers of your respiration. Does that make sense? Does that help? You're welcome. So if for some reason you have a patient that loses control of their diaphragm, okay, the phrenic nerves, okay, if they take and lose control of that diaphragm, then that means that they are going to have issues breathing. If you have any kind of rupture, like a pneumothoracic, okay, you have any kind of rupture of that cavity, basically you take a shot to the chest or you get stabbed in the chest. If that happens, you lose the inability, or you lose the ability to control the pressure in that cavity, because now it equalizes with the pressure outside. Okay, that is going blank. It's a sucking chest wound. Okay, is what it's commonly referred to. If you have a sucking chest wound, that means that pressure is neutralizing or equalizing across your chest. So when you try to actually contract your diaphragm and decrease the pressure in the cavity, all it does is suck the air through the actual sucking chest wound. That's where it gets its name. Okay? and then you can't create that difference in pressure, air builds up in your chest cavity, and you pass out and die. Okay? So, any questions about that? Okay. So, yeah, the chest cavity, your thoracic cavity being sealed off is fairly important, okay, overall. And pressures are too. Alright, so, now, this basically says everything that I just went through, okay, but in a little more detail. So, if you take a look, you have your diaphragm that's going to contract, you have your external iliococcal, your external intercostals, excuse me, I think I misspoke. That's all right. I said iliococcals. Wow. I had a moment. Okay. Yeah. So. Intercostals. Internal and external intercostals. I am sorry. Please fix that in your notes. Okay, so you have this variation in pressure that's created by the muscles and the fact that you have a sealed thoracic cavity. So when you have this sealed thoracic cavity, if you end up ever, like I said, rupturing it, you're going to have issues with pressure. You create this partial vacuum. This partial vacuum is what draws the air in. Okay? Now, why can you take and stretch these muscles, pulling your chest up and not actually breathe in? Well, part of that is that you have some sort of control. Okay? The control that you have, for one, you can close your mouth. Another one is that you have a soft palate, which we're going to talk about here in a little bit. Again, you have a soft palate that can actually take and close off your nasal cavity from your oral cavity. Then you are also going to have vocal cords, okay, these little vocal folds that you can close across called your glottis. And then you're going to have your epiglottis. Okay, you have all of these different control mechanisms to make sure that you don't inhale air or put air into your stomach, even when your thoracic cavity increases in volume or decreases in volume. Okay, good? Okay, so, yay. Here is an image showing the pressures, okay? You get movement of, and in this case it shows your sternum, okay, with your rib cage. So you can see the rotational motion in for an exhalation and out for an inhalation or inspiration, okay? And in this case, you see that based on your intercostal muscles contracting and pulling in, you have your internal intercostals, which will contract down, and you have your external intercostals, which will pull out. Good? Okay. So, big picture respiration. So, you are intaking 20% roughly of oxygen, about 80% nitrogen, and some small percentages of everything else. But for the most part, it's nitrogen and oxygen. Well, when you inhale, you're bringing that in, and 20% is higher than the concentration of the blood that's returning to the lungs to be oxygenated. So that means oxygen moves down its concentration gradient. Okay? Carbon dioxide is higher in the blood than it is in the air you're breathing in, so it's going to move out of its out of your blood down its concentration gradient. So you have this movement of gases. This movement of gases is going from a gas to a liquid. What makes this possible is the actual surfactant, okay? The septal cells, which are going to secrete the surfactant, are what actually allow you to be able to get oxygen into your cells and carbon dioxide out, because it decreases the surface tension of the water that's in your lungs. Because of that, it allows the actual gases to absorb across and into your blood. Good? Okay. So physio goes through that in a whole lot more detail. Deep forced pulmonary ventilation. So here you've got specific muscles. So for a forced inhalation, you're going to have your sternocleidomastoid, your scalenus, and your serratus posterior superior, your pectoralis minor, and your rector spinae. These are all going to contract to, in this case, open up that rib cage. If you can open up that rib cage, you can actually decrease the pressure bringing air in. Okay? Now, if you're forced exhalation, you're trying to collapse down that rib cage. So your transversus thoracis and your serratus posterior inferior and your internal intercostals, your external obliques will contract to pull your rib cage down, and your transversus abdominis will contract to ensure that your abdominal cavity does not actually push out. Okay? That's one of the hopes, is that you don't lose that, because then in that case, all you're doing is inverting your diaphragm. Okay, you don't want to do that. That's kind of a bad thing. So, are we good?
Should we, for the test type of question, would there be something like, what are the muscles for inhalation? What are the muscles for exhalation? Or are you not going that far?
So, it could be.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fair game.
So even if you just pick one, say pick one out of these and
It is fair game. Okay. It's fair game for me to ask you the muscles involved. What's not fair game, and this is why I kind of paused, is the actual process. That's physio. Okay?
So we're talking about
pulmonary. Okay.
You need to know those muscles. You need to know those muscles.
All right. So respiratory is done. Let's go through that test.
So you can ask what muscles are involved in the process of this.
If it's in the slides, it is very good. Just like on your lab. It is in your lab manual. It's very good. There have been a couple things that I've had to mix because they're not in the lab manual. So that's why it's taking me forever to make those practice. All right. Digestive system. So, the development of the digestive system. So, the embryo folds at the lateral edges. Okay, endoderm is going to become the gut tube. You have a foregut, midgut, hindgut. Your foregut consists of what will become your pharynx and your duodenum. So, all the way from your pharynx to your duodenum. Your midgut is going to be your duodenum to your transverse colon. And your hindgut is going to actually be transverse colon to the anal canal. Okay? The gut tube connects to the developing mouth and anus. Okay? Double layer membrane around the gut tube. You have dorsal anchors in the posterior body wall, and you have ventral anchors in the anterior body wall. All right. Let's see if I can remember. Okay, you are a deuterostome. Okay, this is a term that I would know. This is something I will add into the slides at some point, but you are a deuterostome. So, developmentally wise, when you start to develop, the end that forms first is not the mouth. You're pooping before you're speaking. Okay, it's a way to remember it. So, deuterostome. Break the word down. Stone means opening. Deutero means second. So your second opening actually forms first. There are other organisms that are protostomes. Protostomes, their mouth forms first. Okay? Deuterostomes, their renal sphincter is going to form first.
Marsupials, okay. Be the protostome? Protostome?
If I remember questions. Right, all mammals are deuterostomes. Okay? Don't quote me on that, but I remember right, all mammals are deuterostomes. It's when you start to get into your lower vertebrates where you see close ups.
So what is the actual definition you use for improving before the eating?
You can
so you
say
start
that,
to develop from what to what?
So you, your second opening forms first,
okay.
Which means that your rectum is going to form before your mouth. Okay, a big part of the reason why that is important is because of development. You think about it this way. You are living off of your mother. So since you're living off your mother, your wastes are being excreted by her. Your nutrients are coming from her, so you don't need to develop the mouth portion first. Okay, so over time, if you look at evolution, it was more important that you actually be able to get rid of waste initially than to intake new food because of things like, if you look at sharks, okay, sharks have an egg yolk sac that's attached where you would think it's an umbilicus, okay? For a while there, they thought that sharks were placental. It was really interesting. Because they were confused. When you catch a pup shark, okay, you throw it on the table and you look at it and it looks like it has a little umbilical cord scar. Okay? That's not what it is. It's because it was attached to a yolk sac. The yolk sac provided all the nutrients it needed throughout development. It usually breaks off before the shark actually hatches or is birthed, if it's a live birth, oviviparous. But the shark itself will move its way out, and you see that there is the umbilical scar. But the big thing is the shark's teeth don't form first. It's actually the anus that forms first in the shark also. Okay? Good? Alright, so that was a little off topic. Alright. So gastrointestinal tract, GI tract, also known as your alimentary canal. So it is a hollow muscular tube which extends from the mouth to the anus. It performs all the digestive functions, and it goes from your mouth through your large intestine to your colon. Okay, so you have mouth, pharynx, esophagus, stomach, small, large intestine. Small intestine actually comes first, which throws a lot of people off. Okay, you probably saw that in your lab. Some of you probably said, why does it come first? Okay, it's because the large intestine is the collecting duct. So after it's already been spread out and as digested as possible, you collect it together and give it some time. Okay, so because you're collecting all the small things together, it takes longer for it to build up. Gives you some time till you have to go poop next. Okay, because I think I've mentioned this before. If you were peeing and pooping everywhere you were walking, it'd be easy to track and we'd be dead. Okay? Because you'd leave a little trail of breadcrumbs of your poop and pee. That's why things like the urinary bladder and the large intestine exist. Okay? Alright. So, accessory digestive organs. You have your teeth, tongue, salivary glands, pancreas, liver, and gallbladder. Your teeth, of course, maceration, so you're taking and breaking down the food mechanically. Tongue also aids in this. Salivary glands are one of the first places where you will find an enzyme, amylase. Okay? For those of y'all taking physiology next semester, amylase will more than likely come up. ASE endings are enzymes. Okay? Pancreas. Your pancreas is where the majority of your digestive enzymes come from. It is at the start of your small intestine, at the end of your stomach. Okay, so right past with the pyloric sphincter, which we're going to talk about in a minute, you're going to get the insertion of the pancreas, which is where your digestive enzymes, your pancreatic enzymes, are secreted. Okay, that means that you are putting all these enzymes on the food and then letting it pass to the small intestine as you mix it up and move it around, spread it out. Then eventually it hits the end where it will fall into the cecum and into the ascending colon. Good? Alright. So hopefully since you've seen some of this in lab, it's making some sense. The liver itself also will secrete bile. You have a bile duct, okay? It comes from your gallbladder. So you are secreting bile, which has enzymes in it, which will also aid in digestion. Okay, so basic anatomy of this. So you have a parotid salivary gland. So all the way up to your ear, this region here, if you try and push on it, you'll find that there is bone there. Okay? You can't manipulate your salivary gland because of the bone and muscle that's over it. Okay, that salivary gland runs up in there. Now, you also have a sublingual salivary gland. Some people are capable of manipulating this. Okay? If you've ever heard of someone that is capable of bleaking, okay? It's something that I didn't realize until later on that it was, kind of cool. A couple of my friends in high school could do it. It's where you can actually spray your saliva out of your mouth in a straight shot, okay? Having a lot of control to be able to do that. They're taking and actually manipulating their sublingual salivary gland, okay? And possibly their submandibular salivary gland using their tongue and directing it using their tongue. All right. So you've got these accessory digestive organs. Okay. Then after this, you go into your GI tract, which is your digestive organs. You have your oral cavity, your pharynx, your esophagus, your stomach. Your stomach has regions to it. Hopefully you've studied those for your lab. Okay. It also is going to have two sphincters. It has a cardiac and a pyloric sphincter. Okay, so it can open and close, control, so you can have a controlled environment. It secretes hydrochloric acid using mast cells. So the hydrochloric acid that it secretes is actually going to lead to a denaturing of proteins coming in, denaturing of DNA coming in, and a ripping, tearing, and shredding action of the membranes of bacteria. So, hopefully, the bacteria all die in your stomach. That's one of the advantages of having hydrochloric acid secreted in your stomach. Okay, another reason why is because you denature proteins like meat, and that meat protein, okay, or soybean protein, is going to actually be denatured, which makes it easier to break down and digest. Okay? Alright, off of your liver you have this little green organ, even in your cat it looks green, okay? There was no latex injected in it, it literally looks green. It's your gallbladder, okay? So every time I've seen it, it's looked green except for like twice, and I think one of them was a cat, one of the cats we have this year. Okay, you also have a pancreas. The pancreas is actually retroperitoneal. So in your cat, you should have seen it. It was like a gray, looked like little like
cottage cheese.
There you go. It's like a gray cottage cheese under a membrane and connected right into your small intestine. Okay, just beyond your pyloric sphincter, which resides here. All right, digestive system function. So you take in food. You move food around through propulsion, okay, makes it throughout the GI tract. This is mainly through a process called peristalsis, okay, using the smooth muscle. Digestion, which is breaking down of food into nutrients, mechanical and chemical. So you do have the mechanical, which happens in your mouth with maceration, and you are also going to have it happen in your stomach, where you are going to have a mixing action or a rotational action. Absorption. Nutrients are going to move into the blood or lymph from primarily your small intestine. And defecation, which is mainly your large intestine, is going to be removal of waste. Okay? Alright. So, here it is on a diagram. Okay. Ingestion with your mechanical digestion. So first you ingest the food, you start mechanically digesting it by chewing it. It will churn in the stomach, okay? And you do have segmentation. Now, segmentation we'll talk about a little bit, which is what aids in peristalsis. Okay, you have propulsion, so you're swallowing. You have peristalsis, so what peristalsis is? You've got a tube, okay? On this tube, you can take and use the muscles to constrict the diameter of that tube. When you constrict the diameter of that tube in one area, then you can, through linked contractions, okay, so because smooth muscle cells overlap the end of each other, okay, you can actually move this contracted region down, keeping it the same diameter. So what this does is this allows you to push what they call a bolus of food. So you can move that bolus of food down. If you take and contract in another region, you can actually force that bolus of food through that region, which will, if it is not dense food at this time, if you've macerated it well, you can actually push it out almost like the squeeze cheese, okay? So you push it out and it comes out in this small little string. Well, what that does is that increases the surface area in contact with your small intestine, okay? You've also increased the surface area in the small intestine by having microvilli. The microvilli add to the surface area, and you put capillaries all around it and your lymphatic vessels around it also, and now things are going to move down their concentration gradient from the inside, the lumen of your intestinal tract, and out into your capillaries. Good? Okay. So, all right, peritoneum. So, back-to-back layers of serous membrane, you have the parietal peritoneum, which is going to line the body wall. So this is around the outside, parietal peritoneum. Visceral peritoneum, so it surrounds your digestive organs. Your peritoneal cavity is going to be filled between these two spaces. So this image is nice on the left-hand side because it kind of takes it into a basic outline of what's going on. So most of your digestive organs are going to be intraperitoneal, so inside the peritoneum, okay? And they're going to be suspended from the body wall by a dorsal mesentery, and you have a ventral mesentery, okay? In your cat, you have mainly what you saw was a greater omentum, okay? Greater omentum was going to be the one that you see is the dorsal mesentery. Off my head right now. And then you're going to have your lesser omentum, which is going to be on the outside, which is what you saw cover, okay? That is what is remaining of your ventral mesentery. Okay, so some intraperitoneal digestive organs are also going to be suspended by ventral mesenteries. Some digestive organs are retroperitoneal. The ones that I brought up already, okay, is mainly going to be your pancreas. Okay, the other ones you do have. So intraperitoneal, I can ask you locations of these. Liver, stomach, and most of your small intestine is going to be in the peritoneal sac. Okay, you're going to have the cecum, which is that area where things fall out of your small intestine and begin to collect and move up your ascending colon. Okay, you also have your appendix, your transverse colon, and your sigmoidal colon. Okay, sigmoidal colon is a region where it looks a little like an S. Okay, it is not something that's on your lab, and it's not something that's easily found in your cat. Okay, so it's, yeah. Something that doesn't come up unless you're talking about humans. Retroperitoneal organs. Organs located behind the peritoneum. Your kidneys, pancreas, duodenum, the ascending and descending colon, and your rectum are all going to be behind this peritoneal sac. Okay? We're good? Yes.
On our cats, the greater omentum is the skirt that covers all of the intestines.
So, right now, I'm thinking that I'm tired, so I'm going to double check that.
Okay.
Okay. During one of the breaks. Okay. So I just want to make sure that I am right before I go through and tell y'all. Okay, then I'm going off memory and coffee. All right. So mesenteries, back-to-back layers of the peritoneum that extend from the organs to the body wall. It suspends organs in space and stores fat. So you've seen in your cat when you were looking at just the greater omentum. So the omentum, you saw that there was fat stored in it. Okay? It is going to provide a way for blood and lymphatic vessels and nerves to reach your digestive organs. So you can do this really, really cool thing called jump up and down. Okay? Advantages. When you jump up and down, you don't rip all of the blood vessels and nerves out of your digestive tract. Okay? Because of that, what causes that or what creates that ability is these mesenteries. These mesenteries give you a little give. Okay, if you've ever seen like in an auto shop when they have the oil or air gun that's kind of suspended and it's got a little give to it because there's actually an attachment point up there where it's spring loaded. Okay, that's the same thing. Your actual mesenteries are giving you that spring or that stretch in the actual tissue. All right, so your lesser omentum is going to connect the liver to the stomach and duodenum. Okay, your mesentery proper is going to support the long coils of the jejunum and ileum. So, all right, your duodenum, your jejunum, and your ileum. That is the order for your small intestine. So, if you don't already know that, you probably should for your practice. Okay, so your mesocolon, that is the middle colon, and it's going to anchor the transverse and sigmoidal colon to the posterior abdominal wall. Your greater omentum, it is ventral and it covers the transverse colon and small intestine. It is going to wrap the spleen and transverse colon to become the mesocolon in the dorsal region. Good? Okay. So, Greater omentum in this case is in the front, like I was saying earlier. So I was correct. Coffee and memory served me well. Okay, greater omentum was in the front. Now, it goes over the mesentery proper. The mesentery proper is what's holding your small intestine primarily in place in your cat. Okay? And these two dissected images on the bottom are cats. All right. So, general histology of the GI organs. Okay, what I'm going to do, I'm going to take a 10-minute break. Okay, right here, and then we'll come back and start here.